Good morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Martin Fisher is the manager of recorded media collections at the Center for Popular Music here at MTSU. And at the 2007 Real Foot Lake Arts and Crafts Festival, he did some marvelous things that will take you back to those glorious days of yesteryear when all of music and all of recorded sound, spoken word presentations and so forth, were on Edison phonographs, which meant cylinders, these great, big, thick cylinders that were extremely fragile. And you listened out of a gramophone bell that looked like somebody had blown up a petunia about 400 times its normal size. This is for the benefit of those of you who know nothing but the digital generation of electronic equipment. Martin is going to talk about how he preserves sound for the ages and the different formats of recording sound and preserving sound, and how we continue to do that as technology wafts its way over our heads and sometimes drives us into the mist with it. Martin, thank you for being here today.
I appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
I hope somewhere in the course of this program that we'll be able to present to you some of Martin's sound recordings on cylinders. These are contemporary recordings, 21st century recordings on 19th century technology, for all intents and purposes. Martin, first, tell us a little bit about what you do at the Center for Popular Music. What is your job description?
Really, I take care of the recording collection that we have and am in charge of acquisitions, you know, new things that come in either through donations or, of course, I communicate with our people and decide, you know, what we would like to have there if we actually go out and buy things. Or we will sometimes acquire new material, you know, through CD releases that have happened and have come out in the last couple of years. Generally, we'll go by Billboard charts and get like the top 20 on the Hot 100 or Hot 200 list, whatever it's called now, and then a couple of the top country selections and things like that, and try to keep up with current trends as well as, you know, earlier material.
What do you have that could be considered antique? What do you have from, say, the 50s on back?
The 1950s?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'll have some stuff that, you know, like the Elvis has put out and the Beatles and things like that. Of course, the Beatles are a little bit later. But then on back, we concentrate pretty heavily in blues and gospel, regional gospel labels especially. Those are really our, premier off normal popular top stuff. But we do have the Frank Sinatras and the Judy Garlands, and then anything that is more recent in the pop vein, all the way up through, you know, Pink, Prince, and who am I thinking about that has been in the news a lot recently? But Britney Spears, you know.
Okay. Well, it is the Center for Popular Music, after all. But are there any rarities in the collection that would be of interest to people who are collectors or who dabble in the history of these of this area?
Yeah, and here and there we have a lot of what we consider manuscript recordings, one of a kind. We have some stuff from the Ferdy Grofay collection. He's, I guess, most widely known for Grand Canyon Suite. And we inherited, or we acquired a collection from Brad McEwen, who was an RCA executive, amongst other particular titles. He owned the Mega Records label, I believe, here in Nashville as well. We have a lot of his personal recordings that came from, you know, the time that he spent with Victor, and he was also a reissue producer. And as far as commercial recordings go, I don't really know that we have anything astronomically valuable, monetarily, you know, monetary-wise, but we do have a lot of historically important documents, and this, of course, is where the manuscript collection comes in. We'll have lacquers, what a lot of people call acetates, that might be a one-of-a-kind recording, anywhere from either home recordings of folks that would be significant, mm-hmm. you know, either to local music or local history as well.
Now, acetates are pre-vinyl 78s or 45s or 33 1/3. I've seen some 16s. I remember turntables that had actually 16 as one of the speeds, one of the four speeds on it. But I've never seen a record that says play this record at 16.
Mainly, you get that with talking books. So what is it, 16 2/3 and
something
8, and
like
you,
that.
I have to divide it. I can't tell you what the speed is, but it's 8 RPM, 16 RPM, books for the blind, mm-hmm. mainly, and spoken word lectures, things like that. Jimmy Swaggart, I've got a 5 LP set that's recorded at 16 and, what, 2/3, I believe, something like that, RPM. I'd have to look. But, yeah, now acetates, you talk about acetates. There might have been some acetate actually on an acetate at one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of different formulations that were used in that. They either had generally a metal base like aluminum or steel, and I won't get into all of the details because it'd take way too long, or glass even during the World War II years. But it's usually like some sort of cellulose lacquer that's poured over the top, and this is what is used to record even today modern LP masters or, you know, record masters. Those are processed and plated, and then they go through the presses, the derivatives of those, and that's where your vinyl comes from. But they were also sold for home use. If you had a machine like something from one of the, even Sears and Roebuck sold Silvertone models that, or Presto machines that would, you know, you could cut your own discs on. A lot like the cylinder recording I do. They use this type of material as well.
But prior to the space age vinyl, the acetates were highly, highly fragile. If you imagine dropping your mother's best dinner platter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just really did not take much to get a chip or even a huge chunk taken out of it. Whereas you could drop a 33 1/3 record in the 60s and 70s and not necessarily do it all that much harm.
It'd bend a little bit.
Yeah.
And the fact that you have at least three different layers, if you have like a double-sided lacquer, acetate, whatever you want to call it, if you bent that very much, it could pop the lacquer on one side and either cause a crack or, you know, put it under some other sort of stress. And today, these things are self-destructing. That's one of the reasons that you know, folks that are concerned with preservation want to get these things recorded onto another media.
You mean they deteriorate over time?
Right.
The way analog cassette tape deteriorates over time. The oxide, the magnetic oxide, wears off on the tape.
Yeah, could do that or just deform because of the way it's packed on the reels. But, yeah, there's, you know, three different layers and different coefficients of expansion and contraction, and the vinyl, the lacquer on top of the steel, aluminum, or glass base will literally at some point in time might even peel away. You have flaking, and there are some of these things that are already unrecoverable. Or if they get a scratch, the stuff will separate over time, and you'll have a big separation where that scratch was. There'll be a hole, and you can see, you know, the base material through it.
Now,
hard to play.
in attempting to transfer something that's really, really old from the analog equipment on which it was recorded to a digital format, do you have to do anything to it that a purist might say would tamper with the overall sound of the music that the artist intended, or are you just trying to eliminate snaps, crackles, and pops?
Well, to get an archival recording, you don't want to do anything to it. If there's a certain equalization that is known that was used to record this particular thing, then that is the only thing that really for preservation you want to do is you want to just do the complete reverse of what was done during the recording process to get it off in its most natural sound.
Now you've got a recording of Enrico Caruso, for example. You don't want to put it through a graphic equalizer and kick out the highs and the lows. This is one of the great baritones of all time. It's Caruso. Mm-hmm. Even if he's got snaps, crackles, and pops, you've got to preserve Caruso as Caruso in that timbre, right?
That's right. High quality, generally with an acoustic recording in the case of Caruso, because he recorded before the microphone became prevalent in the studio. Generally, the idea there is to transfer everything completely flat, just boost the signal, but don't put any equalization in it. You want both sides, the left and the right, because, you know, one of these days that could be useful information, and it already is. So transfer a stereo signal with the proper stylus. Of course, clean the record good, and there are various and sundry playback techniques and things that you can do during that initial transfer. If the initial transfer is not good, I'm sorry, you've lost it. You can't fix it in post. You know, you can cover it up, you can smooth it over, you can rub a layer of, you know, grease over it, but it's still going to be bad underneath. You know, and you really can't do much with it then. Get a first initial flat transfer.
And technicians can tell the difference. They can tell what was messed up at the time of the actual recording. They can tell what was messed up in the attempt to transfer, and they can tell what natural flaws have occurred just through the process of aging and collecting dust.
Right. You can hear everything that was present in the studio at the time, essentially. And then if a reissue, you know, if you want to reissue this for the masses, then a producer can take that original flat transfer, which is made for preservation. That is the thing that really needs to survive. And then he can tamper with it, but you've still got the original to work from. You know, make a copy of that original and then mess with it, mm-hmm. You know.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and everybody's going to be different. You know, what I want to hear at home might be the opposite of what you want to hear. I myself want to hear a flat transfer with all of the crud in it, you know, and I can take that out, or if somebody's good at it, they can do it. That'll satisfy me.
Well, you know what is interesting? When I was a child and I would listen to WSMAM late at night, pardon me for mentioning another call letter, another group of call letters, but when Ralph Emery had a show in the wee hours of the morning, and the Ernest Tubb Record Show had its own program in the wee hours of the morning, they would play these Jimmy Rogers records from the 1930s. And the snap, crackle, and pop, and the plaintive, lonesome wail of Rogers singing, and the quality of his voice coming through my little AM radio at dark 30 in the morning with me in my bed, it was all atmospherics, I grant you, but it really did transport me back to that Great Depression era and make me feel as though I were in the 1930s listening to Jimmy Rogers on the radio, perhaps in Oklahoma trying to pick up WSMAM and its clear channel signal. So there's something to be said to listening to old recordings with all of the snaps, crackles, and pops built in. Isn't
and on
there?
Original equipment or something equivalent. If you're listening to an AM broadcast, it is colored because of the frequency spectrum. You listen to the same thing on FM and it's different. If you're listening on a small AM radio, it can actually take you sort of back into the 20s and 30s. I mean, you listen to one of the Ernest Tubb broadcasts today and it's not much from, you know, listening to the same in the 60s.
Right.
You know, it's over AM radio. It's colored because of the timbre of the frequency spectrum that is available on AM radio and your particular model you're sitting in front of. It can sound like something from the 60s even though it's live.
Plus, people wonder why they listen to certain recordings of, say, War of the Worlds. Orson Welles' production of H.G. Wells' classic, which was on CBS radio back in the day, and they wonder why it fades in and out in places. Well, some copies of War of the Worlds were recorded right there, or are copies of things that were recorded right there at CBS at the time this live broadcast was happening, and some of them were recorded off the radio by some amateur just sticking his microphone up to his radio.
Right. You got the fade-ins and the fade-outs. And actually, I think in some of that broadcast, some of them were probably intentional to sound like it was atmospheric conditions or, you know, the radio network at the time that, you know, that this broadcast was going on. They were supposedly trying to make you think that they were linking from this distant location to that distant location.
Right.
And you had all of the pauses and the fades, too. Yes, what you're saying is true. But we can go a step further and say some of that was built in as well.
Yeah, some of it was part of Orson Welles' plan to have these, you know, certain sound effects
and
that make you
worked.
Think that you are trying to connect. You really do believe that you are listening to reporters in the field. It's extraordinary, and it's not as though they had sophisticated sound effects to work with. They just had their own imaginations. With regard to the Edison-style phonograph and these cylinders, and I promise we'll get to this in just a minute, explain to folks what kind of what an Edison phonograph looks like. Describe it, if you will, and explain these little black cylinders on which the sound was recorded and on which it is played back.
It's easier, actually, to give you a description of the cylinder. You just about have to see a machine. The standard cylinders were about 4 inches long, 2 inches in diameter. Some folks would say it looked like a toilet paper tube.
Yeah.
Or some folks will say a beer can or a Coke can or something
like that. But they're thick. They're heavier than you think they are.
Yeah, a little bit. And they're probably around a quarter of an inch thick in the walls are. And that could be... go either way a little bit, according to how, if these things are actually shaved down to use again.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I use are actually a composition that is close, not perfect, but close to the commercial cylinders that were being issued and or that were just out there between 1890-ish up through 1902.
Now, how and where do you get those types of cylinders today?
The ones that I get... I order from a fellow named Paul Morris that lives over in England, the Devon, Exeter area. And I'll write him, you know, on the wonderful internet and say, you know, Paul, I need 20 blanks or 50 blanks. And he came up with a group of 100 for me recently. And I can either PayPal him the money or, you know, send him a check or something. And he just ships the stuff over to me. We have a relationship where we just exchange freely.
So this is very much a one-on-one. It's not as though anybody is still manufacturing these things for mass consumption anymore.
He is, and there's one other person here in the United States that also does that. But I generally deal with Paul because he's got a real good formula going, and they work nicely.
And the chemical composition of these cylinders is close to the chemical composition of the cylinders that Edison actually used on his own invention.
Right.
What, if any, difference in sound quality would there be, taking into consideration the ravages of age and so forth?
Oh, between the ones that I do?
Yeah.
They're probably not as clear, actually. But there's a difference in the commercially issued ones that were late in that era, like 1895 or so. Most of those were actually copies, say 1898 up to 1902, 1904. And then we go into a whole new different type of composition, but those were actually cut one at a time, one on one. Usually by that time a master was cut, and then that was mechanically transferred over to another one, and the linkages or the fact that, you know, you're going through a tube from one reproducer to the recorder on the other machine colored the sound just like the AM radio. And if there are mechanical linkages, there's distortion that's introduced. The difference in what I do is all of those are recorded one at a time with the person sitting, standing, whatever, in front of the horn, playing, speaking, making noises, screaming at the top of their lungs, as recently somebody did. And they're first-generation recording. Mine are probably a little bit more noisy because the chemical composition is a little different, and I'm using my own particular modified recording head as well.
If a non-professional or non-specialist listened to the exact same song recorded on one of your cylinders and recorded back around the turn of the century on an Edison cylinder, could he or she tell the difference?
Probably.
Even an amateur could tell the difference, you think?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know.
I mean, just your average person.
Probably not.
Listening.
Probably
okay.
Not.
Let's listen to something right now that you recorded on one of these cylinders. This is from the Real Foot Lake Arts and Crafts Festival of 2007, I believe. And this is The Old Man and the Lawyer. And the name of the artist escapes me. Can you
Jeff Long.
Jeff Long. Now let's see what this sounds like to you.
All right, I am Jeff Long, and I'm going to do an original song here that was actually happened in Henderson County in the courthouse, and I call it The Old Man and the Lawyer. Now, Mr. Philip Stanton, Esquire, he was a lawyer in our town. He defended all the bad guys. He was known for miles around. Well, he drove a big Mercedes, and he wore expensive suits. And when he graced the courtroom, he very seldom lose. Now, one day, this old farmer was called to take the stand. He showed up in bibs overalls, had a straw hat in his right hand. Well, they swore him in. He sat down and the DA asked his name. Well, Levi West was his reply. Don't expect that'll ever change. Well, it happened that old Levi West was a witness to a crime. And the man that did the robbery was Philip Stanton's wife. See, the lawyer planned to make that old farmer out to be a fool. And his harsh words to the old man nearly knocked him off his stool. Now, you testified you saw the robbery, Mr. Levi West. But it was 10 p.m. in a parking lot. You were the only eyewitness. You were several yards away, sir. Do your eyes still see that good? You telling this court you could see my client from where you stood? Well, the old man slowly rolled his eyes, softly said, that's right. Then the lawyer said, just how far can you see at night? Well, the old man's face turned crimson red, and he tipped his old straw hat. He said, well, mister, I can see the moon. Now tell me, smart aleck, how far is that?
Sizzle, 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 sizzle. Noticed it dropped off at one point there, and the volume kind of went down about two-thirds of the way through it. Other than that, it sounds very much as though you were you had just stumbled onto one of Alan Lomax's recordings from out in the fields of the South or something. What is the value to you and to the art that you practice of recording something in the 21st century in a 19th century mode?
It's fun.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. being a record collector and getting into this sort of thing, it's neat. It's something that that I just enjoy. I can't give you any high lofty reasons and, oh, it's for the masses to da-da-da-da-da, history here and there. That's fine, and it's great. But, you know, the look on people's faces when they hear themselves coming back, you know, and especially if they ever put ear tubes in their ears, which is the best way to actually listen to these on the original equipment. You know, the difference between listening through a horn and listening through ear tubes, which are like headphones and great fidelity, it bumps it up. The smile that comes over these people's faces, you know, it's wonderful to see. And you meet some of the coolest people and make such good friends, you know, when you do stuff like this.
In listening to some of the other things on the CD that you have made that were recorded in this mode, half of the tracks on the CD were recorded on the cylinder equipment. The other half were recorded with modern equipment, the exact same personnel, exact same songs.
At the exact same time.
At the exact same time. And you'll notice, however, if you listen to certain of the introductions to some of these pieces, it sounded as though they were trying to reproduce the announcing style of yesteryear with these great stentorian tones that one might hear on an Edison phonograph. rather like that.
Yeah, most of these announcements were actually by Bruce Nemirov, who was having fun with it.
Oh, he hooked it up.
who's got a very great cut of something he terms real foot blues. He's playing a little like bottleneck guitar on there.
I have an audio clip of it's on a I can't remember now whether it's on a CD or a cassette tape, but obviously it was recorded or dubbed from an Edison phonograph. It is a commercial, in essence. It's something that you would go into the store and the dealer would play the cylinder on the phonograph just to demonstrate to you how it works. And the guy is talking like this. He is talking as though he personally, the recorded voice on the cylinder, is the phonograph. And he goes, "I am the Edison phonograph. I can make music. I can bring opera into your home. I can keep the children busy while you tend to your chores. Ask the dealer."
That's right. That was Len Spencer, and he was recording specifically to advertise the Edison phonograph through itself.
How'd I do with the copy?
Did pretty good, actually.
Pretty good for a soprano?
Great, yeah.
Okay.
He's very popular during the day. He started out in the mid-90s probably, and went on through the 20s up until, I believe, he died. He recorded until he died. And his partner was Ada Jones. They did a lot of stuff together.
Did he live to see the day of vinyl? Didn't live quite that long?
Oh, no. He died before electric recording came out commercially. I'm thinking around 22, but I'd really have to check myself on that.
Now, I listen to a lot of old-timey radio, and you can really get confused listening to the show when Don Wilson says, "The Jack Benny Program, transcribed." Well, to me, transcribing something means writing out the words that were spoken during the course of the program, or writing out the script by listening to a recording. Back then, transcribed meant this is a pre-recorded program. This is not live. The word meant something completely different. I had to listen to heaven knows how many old radio programs before it finally sunk into my thick head that the why does he say transcribed? With Bing Crosby, I understand, and cut a deal with Ampex, the German audio tape maker that just really totally revolutionized this whole process. We wouldn't be sitting here today talking about this stuff if it weren't for Bing Crosby, I suspect, don't you think?
Quite possibly. Even after Crosby started recording his show, and I am no expert on this particular subject, but it's fascinating. The studios, for several years, most of them, like the big names, still recorded on lacquer disc and did transfers from like a master disc over dubbings, essentially, over to the format that they were going to release, be that 78, 45, 33. And, of course, tape revolutionized the process. You had easy editing. They actually did edit on discs, especially Vitaphone, back in the early talkie days. But, and it just totally revolutionized things. Here you could, if you made a mistake, you could edit it out, redo it, pop it in, whatever. It really did make a difference. And, of course, the fidelity shot way up on the final recording.
Does the YouTube generation appreciate the necessity or the reason for the preservation of the old formats and the old sounds? Do they ever say to you, why does it matter what Theodore Roosevelt sounded like when he spoke? Or why does it matter what Charles Evan Hughes sounded like? Or Justice Brandeis? Or William Howard Taft? Why do these things matter? Or are they so into any and all aspect of audio and video production that they want to experience the entire spectrum?
That's a loaded question, really. you're almost asking me, do they think it's the same if you read something that somebody said, or listen to something that somebody said, and you have the vocal inflections, you have the personality that comes through. Even the media will color the personality. And in a lot of ways, in other words, or for instance, have you got a dead family member that you never heard? Your grandfather, your great grandmother, might have made a recording on a little home disc or something, and you discover it years later, And, you know, whether or not you can actually play the thing, bring it to somebody like me that, you know, can transfer it. And there's folks out there that can do that. But, you know, you could hear it. You can hear their voice. And their personality will come through on that voice. Not only can you see them through a picture or even through silent film, but now you have the voice to go with it. The thing that actually happened to me with my grandfather, who I never knew, and I think we have him on record. Not quite sure if it's actually him in a quartet or not. But, you know, so much comes through. A sound is worth a thousand words like a picture is.
We're going to have to bring you back. This has been really fun.
It takes a long time to cover this, doesn't it?
It sure does, and because there's much more to talk about with this. Martin Fisher from the Center for Popular Music, the manager of Recorded Media Collections there. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. You can catch us at mtsunews.com and download the podcast at your leisure. And We don't have any cylinders to offer you, but we are available on iTunes. Ask the dealer.